Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation recorded live during the May 2015 Home Education Conference held in Williamsburg, Virginia.
All right, so my name again is Brother Robert Mackey. This is The Myths of Mental Illness. I'm going to be talking about some common themes going with things that I've found that I'm working with LDS Family Services and dealing with things like depression or anxiety, other common mental illnesses that you maybe more specifically how to recognize them in your children or others or even within yourself. Not only knowing how to recognize them, but what to do as well with them. I wanted to tell you a story first about something that happened here to me recently. I had a birthday just last month, I can still say, I guess. And my wonderful wife got me a barbecue. This is my barbecue. This is it. And it's beautiful. It's the best barbecue I've ever had. I was excited to get it. I was grateful. I'd been wanting one. I'd only had a really small, kind of rusty dinky one for many years, and it had done its job, but with a growing family and things that we like to do, I wanted something bigger. I was excited when my wife got it. One thing that I needed to do with it, though, is I needed to put it together. And so that is not one of my strong suits, putting things together, mechanically at least, or with tools and things, but I felt confident. I felt comfortable being able to do so. I'd known other people that had done it, and thought I could follow the instructions rather well. I wanted to bring the instruction booklet here. It was literally about 3 feet long. I'd never seen an instruction booklet. And when you open it up, it's about 3 feet wide. It's this huge. When I laid it on top here of the barbecue, I'd lay it on and open it up. It covered the whole grill top. I don't know why it was so massive. It was this huge, huge grill instruction booklet of how to put it together. So I figured it might have some good instructions, help me understand how to go ahead and put it together. As I got going, I made sure, I usually like lining up, making sure I have all the pieces I need, I have the tools I need before I get started, and I felt comfortable being able to do that, and I got going. As I got going, there were some parts that took a little bit longer than I would like to have taken. Probably someone else who knew what they were doing better probably would have been able to help me if I had an expert there or someone who knew how to put these together rather well. But eventually, I got it done. It was up. It looked like this, and I was excited. It was finally done with only a few slip-ups. Then I went to go and see how it worked. As I tried to click it on, there was one big problem. There was no flame, and so the gas was attached correctly. I could hear the gas coming out, but there was no flame, nothing, and it's kind of pointless to have this beautiful-looking grill with no flame, right? Not going to be able to do much with hamburgers or chicken or whatever it was that we wanted to put on there to get us the food we wanted. That was a little frustrating. I looked and looked. I looked through the huge, ginormous instruction booklet. I couldn't find anything that I had done wrong. I looked through everything that I could possibly see. I finally looked some things up online, and so now this process was taking even longer. And I thought I had found something. The igniter had not been connected. And I went back and looked. There's nothing that says when to officially connect it. So I don't know if it was supposed to be connected. But I found a place that I thought it was supposed to go in. The first time I tried it, it didn't work. But I just had to put it up a little bit more. And finally it worked. And I was grateful. But another thing. So the grill finally worked. But the stovetop one over here didn't. And so my father came out, not for this. But he flew out from California to visit us last week. And so after I'd had this for about a month, and I'd used the grill enough, and I don't know if I'm going to even really use the side one much. I've never used one before, but I would like it to work. And so he helped me. He's a lot more mechanically inclined. He's an engineer by trade. I would say he was the computer nerd, and I didn't get that gene, so I talk about feelings. But he was able to help me see how to get that. So after a long process, and even probably a full month, now it's finally fully functional. It wasn't what I was hoping for as far as getting it started right away, but eventually we were able to get it going. And I'm grateful. It cooks wonderfully. And I'd like to relate that a little bit to what we're talking about today. When I talk about the myths of mental illness, and specifically, again, when preparing this, I thought a lot about how to how to help the children that you may have or that you may work with. Again, I think all these tips might help you for yourself and adults as well, but I work with youth as well at church. I've done that a lot of my church colleagues have dealt with youth in one way or another, and so I think about them often. And in the same way, I think about when we first had kids. I know for me it was kind of similar. I was very excited to have kids. My wife and I, we planned it. I was excited when that time came. Some people say there's not a huge instruction booklet or any, but in a way there is. There's tons of information. My wife bought all kinds of books, everything from the What to Expect When You're Expecting series to, and then as you become parents and you can look up online, there's lots of things you can actually learn. But applying it sometimes is a little bit different. I have this all this information, and children are different too. Sometimes, just like this, you can start raising them up, and it seems like on the outside everything is fine. But sometimes on the inside, it's not working quite so well, like my grill. It looked beautiful. It looked just like this, bright red and shiny. And sometimes that's how it can be with us or our children. With mental illness, you don't know what's going on inside. You don't know what's not sparking there, what's not quite working correctly, or if there even is a problem, if it maybe just malfunctioned a bit. That's sometimes how it sometimes feels. But when we get some advice, sometimes we need to make sure that we're seeking for support from the right people, right? We need to talk to our Heavenly Father. We need to talk to our close, trusted family, friends, family members. We need to talk to our bishop. We need to talk to professional counselors, maybe to a doctor. As we do that, then we're able to hopefully be able to find things that will help us be able to help our children, that's again, or ourselves. And that's what I'd like to be able to talk a little bit about today. I'll sometimes like to begin with the end in mind, and I'm going to give you what I call my equation for healing. And if I recognize a couple of you, and I usually use this, but I'm going to probably say it for the rest of my life in one way or another, because it's something that's blessed my life. As I think about healing, when I first started getting into counseling, I remember hearing the phrase that time heals all wounds. And probably many of you heard that in some way or another. That's hopefully you understand that that's just not true. That's a false theory there, that just time itself heals all wounds. That's part of the equation, though. That's the first part. Because time, I've seen where time does the opposite. I've seen where time has made things, people become bitter and fester anger longer and longer and cause so much discord and discontent within people's own lives or relationships that it's hurt. So it's what you do with that time. So the thing I added to it was realizing that you've got to do your part. You've got to work. So time plus work. And that's when I was getting into my schooling with counseling. I thought, okay, we've got time. Yes, it does need to pass. That is important, whether it's 5 minutes to cool down before I re-engage talking to someone that I was having an argument with. Maybe that's all I needed was that time. It might be 5 months for some longer hurt. Who knows? I don't know. There's different timelines. But that work that we do is what's going to be vital for us to be able to make sure that we don't become bitter, that we start the healing process. That might mean we need to calm ourselves down through different ways, and we'll talk about some of those a little bit later. It might mean that we go and talk to our bishop, or we talk to a counselor. It might mean we need to talk to a doctor, right? If you break an arm or a leg, you know, just say, I'm just going to hold off for a couple months, and it'll all be better. We go see a doctor. We get a cast on it. We work it out in that way, maybe physical therapy. And in the same way, that's what happens with mental illness. So time plus work, but I realized I was missing one key piece. Especially as I started my professional career, I was able to start working with the church, and I realized something I had missed that was right in front of my face the whole time, my whole life. Been a member of the church, and I realized that last piece was time plus work plus the Savior and His atonement is what truly heals all wounds. And I'd like to start with that and keep that in mind as we go through the things I talk about, because to me, all the time that goes by and all the work that we do can sometimes be meaningless if we don't include the Savior. He's the one that's been below it all. He's the one that can help us and guide us, give us direction about what work we should be doing to heal, or to give us that just gem of a blessing sometimes, even beyond whatever work we do. He sometimes gives us that blessing of just being healed, and that could be for those that are hurt or those who have been hurt. And so that's my equation. And so as we go on, I want to talk about that. Now, I want to talk about some myths of mental illness. That's the title of this class, and so I want to label some of these out there. This comes from a general authority. It was in the Ensign a few years back. His name was Elder Alexander Morrison. And I love, I used to have my own things, but when he finally came out and said this, it was wonderful because it wasn't just from me. Of course, I'm going to say there's myths of mental illness. I'm a counselor. That's what you're supposed to say. And I got some of those comments from time to time. Even some of the things that I thought about or as I would say them, I always wish that I had it. The church has come out with many good materials now and great talks. Elder Holland just recently has talked a lot about depression and conference and other things. And so let's just go with, I want to go through, I only picked out a few of them. If you'd like to, it's the October 2005 conference, or not conference issue, but it was where Elder Morrison had put this in the Ensign, if you want to read the full article. The first one is that all mental illness is caused by sin. That's one that he had heard a lot, and that's just completely untrue. And I hope that you all know that. I hear that, unfortunately, still not as much, but a little bit, where people think that you must have done something wrong if you're suffering in this way. And how false is that? It's just ridiculous to think. Now, I do believe that at times that there is cause. If we are sinning, if we are doing something wrong, that yes, that can cause some problems in our life, absolutely. But that's not the only cause. And what he actually said in here, and I like to read it here. It says, the truth is that many faithful Latter-day Saints who live the commandments and honor their covenants experience struggles with mental illness or are required to deal with the intense pain and suffering of morally righteous but mentally ill family members. Their burdens, and they are many, can be lifted only by love, understanding, and acceptance. And I think that's an important thing to recognize, that sometimes incredibly faithful, honorable, doing the best they can, members of the church, none of us are perfect, we're trying our best, can suffer. It has nothing to do necessarily with your righteousness. If it is, then go and repent and change some of those ways, but I'd say a majority of the time it has nothing to do with sin. And so I just want to make sure that that's out there first and foremost. They're not all caused by sin. The next one, he says that someone's to blame for mental illness. This is one where people often subscribe, I call it to the shame and blame game, where whenever there's something going wrong, oh, it's because you're doing this. And they say they blame you or someone else. It's because of something that happened to you. It's because of this. It's because of that. Those can, that might be one of the influencing factors in your life. Absolutely. But it's not, as we just play that shame and blame game, I think that's the game Satan wants us to play. He wants us to be blaming others or blaming ourselves. He wants us to feel ashamed, not good enough to pray even, to talk to Heavenly Father, or shame to not feel that we're worthy to even have friends. And that's not true. It's not always someone's to blame. He says, ascribing blame for mental illness causes unnecessary suffering for all concerned and takes time and energy, which would be better used to increase understanding of what actually is happening. I love that part. It's just wasted time. As we sit there and try to look for who's to blame or to feel ashamed, it's just wasted time. And if we realize we need to use that time better to find out what's actually happening, he then goes on and says, so we can get a complete assessment and proper diagnosis of the illnesses involved, to understand the causes, to get proper medication, and learn behavioral and cognitive techniques that are part of the healing process. That's the work part, all that stuff that he mentioned of the healing process, my healing equation. You've got to do your part. Use that time. There's something going on. I'm not saying you can just simply, with a turn of a switch, say, I'm all better now. I'm not sad. I'm not depressed. I'm not anxious. But instead of looking for who's to blame and what's going on there, to actually look at it and say, hold on, I'm going to go and seek some help. I'm going to go talk to someone. I'm going to read up on this. I'm going to try different things. That's what you should be doing with that time, and not looking for the blame. So the next one is that all people with mental illness need is a priesthood blessing. This, I work, one of my main jobs with LDS Family Services is to consult with bishops. And bishops change every 5 years. I cover 11 stakes. It's over 100 bishops that I work with on and off. And they change almost about every other week. There's a new bishop that I, in the areas that I cover, that is called. And so it's somewhere in the state of Virginia. And so that's a lot. So some new people come in and we consult. We help let them know how to work with people. And from time to time, I'll hear this, like, is counseling even needed? I think I just need to give them a blessing and it'll be fine. Now, certainly, let me even read his quote, because from a general authority, I love hearing it from his words too. Because after, and if you read the whole article, he bears a strong testimony of priesthood blessings. Make sure people understand that he has a testimony of them and that we should use them. But then he goes on and he says, we must understand, however, that without in any way degenerating from the unique role of the priesthood blessings, that ecclesiastical leaders are spiritual leaders and not mental health professionals. Most of them lack the professional skills and training to deal effectively with deep-seated mental illness and are well advised to seek competent professional assistance for those in their charge who are in need of it. And so beyond bishops, that also goes to within our own homes. Again, I would always ascribe, I actually tell most of my clients or recommend, I'll ask, have you received a priesthood blessing? I think that's something you should seek out, whether it's from the child, from your father, from your bishop, from your young men's leader, from a home teacher, from whoever. I work a lot with missionaries, it might be their mission president, whoever. Go ahead and get that, but that's not the only thing. It's not a faith issue. Mental illness is real. Mental illness is something, just as much as we wouldn't say to someone with that broken arm or with cancer, just get a blessing and don't go to the doctors. There's no need for it. All you need is faith. Now, to me, that sounds silly to me. I wouldn't say that. I take my kid to the emergency room right away if he needs it. But do I also give a blessing? Absolutely. You absolutely do that as part of the step. That's part of the work. But let's not make sure that we're holding people back that are in actual need of help. And so that's an important part as well. The next one, he says, mentally ill people just lack willpower. And to me, this kind of goes along that same line, whether it's faith or just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. That's all you got to do. Why can't you just get out of bed? Why can't you just go enjoy life? Why can't you fill in the blank? Whether it's grief, again, or anxiety, or any of those things. If you just made the choice. I hear that so much. I hear that from my own clients. I don't know why I can't just do it. And I tell them, well, there might be a legitimate reason. Now, you might have even legitimate chemical imbalances in your mind that you might need medication. And my deal with medication is I always tell people, it's kind of, you don't just take medication as a magic pill. It's something that's there to help. And I compare it to when you're sitting on a block. Imagine you're sitting on a block of ice in your car, a slick, slick, slick block of ice. And you do all that you can to get that car moving. You turn the car on, you put it in gear, you push the pedal, and the wheels just spin. You're doing everything in your power. You even get out and try to push, and you're going nowhere. You're slipping. You're feeling like you're falling on your face. Now you get the medication. What the medication would be the traction, the salt, the sand, whatever it is that you throw down to help you. But if you get in that car now with all the salt and sand down and traction and just sit there in the chair, say, okay, well, I should be good. Why aren't I at my destination yet? It's because you're not doing the work. And I think that's an important part, that it just allows you, the medication just allows your mind to now do the work, to now put it in gear, turn it on, push the pedal, and now you can move. So you can't just, to me, it's about using both. But it's not just simply lacking willpower. And this is what he has to say, too, about it. He says, the fact is that seriously mentally ill persons simply cannot, through an exercise of pure will, get out of the predicament they are in. They need help, encouragement, understanding, and love. We don't say to persons with heart diseases or cancer, just grow up and get over it. Neither should we treat the mentally ill in such an uncompassionate and unhelpful way. And I like thinking about that. There's just two more that I just think are good. I'm going to put them both up here. That mental illness doesn't strike children. It absolutely does. And I'll just simply say that right now the number is about 1 in 5, about 20% of children have been diagnosed. That doesn't mean even all of them are found out, but that's probably a pretty good accurate statement there. They've kept numbers for many, many years now. And that can help, that can disrupt their functioning at home, at school, at church, and just socially. And so that's something to just be aware of, that it is real. Some people thought, oh no, it doesn't ever happen. That's just kids being kids. Or people ask me, what's the difference in a child going through puberty and mental illness? It kind of looks alike. A lot of people will say, I've heard that. Parents will bring their teen, I understand that. There's sometimes you see that, and you're like, oh, what is the difference? And we'll talk maybe a little bit about that a little bit when I talk about some of the extremes and maybe social norms as well. So just understand that it does happen to children, and it's better to get treatment. Mental illness, also the final thing is that it's untreatable. I've had people talk about that. Well, it's just there. I guess that's just who I am. People even label themselves with their disorder, and I don't like that. I am bipolar. Or something like that. It's, you know, that's something that you just like. You aren't your broken arm. You aren't your cancer. That's something that you have. You've been diagnosed with. Let's learn to work with it and try to overcome it as best we can. And I love, this was Elder Holland in his talk. He said, "Broken minds can be healed just the way broken bones and broken hearts are healed. While God is at work making those repairs, the rest of us can help by being merciful non-judgmental and kind. And I love that thought, because that's what we need to do. We need to help out as best we can, non-judgmentally kind and seeking to help. And I wouldn't be here if I thought that it wasn't treatable. And so, and I've seen the great blessing that that healing can bring that I mentioned, that healing through people as time goes by and they do their part and the atonement works in their life. I want to talk about some warning signs. Now, I'm going to put up just a bunch here right now because I just want to throw them all out there, and I'm not going to go over every single one of them. I gave my PowerPoint to the people running this, so it'll be up on the website afterwards or wherever they're posting them if you would like some of these. But I want to talk about what some of the key factors are, though, as I just put up a bunch that have to do with some of the kind of depression, anxiety, some of the major ones that actually are seen a lot. The key difference, if you can read some of these, or the key element to look for, is the excessiveness or the extremeness of situations. It's when there's extremes that we have a problem. That's where we potentially have a problem, right? It's excessive worry and fear. It's extreme or excessive sadness or low. It's extreme mood changes. So it's not just a bad day. It's not just I felt sad. And it's not even. And so you look for extremes, and you also look for how prolonged it is. Is this something that's just happened over a week? Has something bad happened? Is it something that's gone on for months? Something that I've noticed in my child since they were born? And it's excessive. And what I always say, you have to look at kind of some social norms too. We sometimes have higher standards than what's actually out there, or maybe lower standards than what's actually out there. And I say it's important to look at what's kind of the standard. You know, if most kids around this age kind of seem like this, doesn't mean it's right necessarily. It doesn't, but it's something to look at. If that's the social kind of the norm, then you've got to look at that. But the excessiveness and the extremeness of the child's symptoms or your own are what to look at. So you look at this. Avoiding friends and social activities. Again, is that different or is it extreme that they go out of their way to avoid, or they're just a shy child? There's a big difference in someone who has social anxiety and I'm just kind of shy, or the depression, the grief that you go through. So as you look over those, again, I'm not going to read over every single one, but all of those have to do with the excessiveness or extremeness of it. That's how you're going to recognize, is this truly a mental illness? Is this truly something that I need to worry about? Again, I'll go back to the key for me is that you openly talk about this, whether it's with your child, with your spouse, with a friend, with a trusted family member, with a mental health worker. And so all these things are some things that you can look at. Again, extreme weight gains or weight loss, inability to carry on daily activities. I mean, there's all kinds of things here, but make sure you look at how extreme is it. Is it just going through a rough patch? I want to talk a little bit more about that, though. This is a chart that I like to use that I'll share with people a lot that helps put a little into perspective what we're talking about. Because when you're looking at the severity of mental illness, some of these things I've already mentioned, right? There's a few different areas here, and I'll go over some of these, the duration of how long it's been going on. Again, is it expected, too? Did someone just pass away in the family? What's going on there? And, you know, and so that's going to be more than just a week of sadness, possibly, if it's someone they're close to. The duration, ability to function, ability to face reality, and the suicide risk. And so I want to just, hopefully you can see most of that. Again, it's on the PowerPoint that I gave to them for the website. But let's talk about these. So the mild side of things, first of all, the duration is, it only lasts as long as the thing is there. So we might be talking about a big test that's coming up, right? Or there's a dance coming up. It could even be a social experience. You know, it'd be something that's stressing someone out. It could be something. If the stress lifts after they get their driver's license, that causes a lot of stress for some of these teens. You finally get that, then that was just mild. That was okay, that was expected, and it looks, and so you can kind of see that. Okay, it looks like it's better now. So their ability to function now, they were able to handle their responsibilities. I talk about functioning a lot. Are they able to, that's a big key too. If they're able to function for the most part, still do their schoolwork, still take care of the responsibilities if they have other responsibilities at home, whether that's chores or if they have a job, yourself, if you're able to, I say, well, you can go to your job or do your responsibilities around the house, you're able to handle those through mild stress and mental illness possibly that you just think that you have. Now, you may, the ability to face reality, you may overreact, but you're able to cope because we're not perfect. There's times that I get home, I overreact to my children, to my wife, to my coworkers at times, and I'm a little anxious. I'm on edge. That's relatively normal. We hopefully have all had some of those experiences from time to time. And the suicide risk, really, usually there's no risk or it's very low if it's just in this mild range. Okay? So you need to recognize that. As we get into the moderate range, though, this is one the duration can last for weeks, months, and even years. And people say, years? How is that moderate? That seems pretty severe. And it just depends on how the, it kind of goes into the rest of these, how the functioning works. If you're still functioning, I've had people who've dealt with, I've counseled someone who for 3.5 years is a woman that I'm counseling. She's been coming, but she's gone through graduate school. She's got a professional career now. And this has all happened during counseling. But she's been dealing with some pretty, at times, extreme depression, but she's learning coping skills on how to manage those. She's functioning well. She doesn't miss work because of the depression, but it's there, and it's been there for longer than when she came to me. She had counseling when she was a teenager, and then in college before I started seeing her in graduate school, and now after. And she's getting better. It's a little further apart, but she still experiences those. So know that it can, for you or your children, it could be something, again, that you've seen their whole life. Now, the ability to function, it's reduced a little bit than some of the severe ones. It's reduced, but the person just seems to be getting by. Now, sometimes it just feels like I'm just getting by. Every day, I'm just finally glad to lay down. I finally made it. Every day, I just feel like I got a crash. And has anyone ever felt like that? Because I've felt like that. So sometimes, again, we've all had those days, but is this persistent? Has it gone on for months where every single day, I just feel like I just finally got by? That's probably more in the moderate range then. If you're not, the joy is not as strongly there. Your ability to face reality, you face it, but you see yourself very negatively. You feel pretty hopeless about things and helpless. There's a low to possibly high level of suicide risk. That's something in the moderate range you do want to start assessing, okay, where are we at? What is happening here? And you want to even ask those questions. I think it's important to open up that door and say, have you ever had thoughts of hurting yourself? Usually when someone's experiencing a lot of depression or sadness or they're feeling low, it's common for those thoughts to even flash in your mind. And I try to normalize it even for people and say, that's relatively common. Have you ever had those? And when you kind of normalize it, they're not as afraid to open up and say, I have had those thoughts from time to time. I never had a plan, maybe. Or maybe they do lay out a whole plan. Yeah, I just wish I think things would be better if I were gone. So you've got to assess that. That's important. And it's okay to ask that. Have you ever had those thoughts? Have you ever known anyone at your school? If you're talking to your kids that have talked about it, or maybe someone has attempted or successfully tried to commit suicide. That's important to talk about. I think that's one where I say a lot of times people are just sitting in silence and we don't ask them, so we don't give them permission to actually talk about that. That sounds too taboo. So I think it's good to ask that, just to check. Now when we get into severe, though, this is chronic, brief and intense in crises, the duration, meaning sometimes it could be brief where it's just in this moment. I'm severely depressed right now. If I went home today and my child had died, I would be immediately, I think, into the severe range. I think immediately. And right then and there, it would just happen. And now maybe I would overcome that again and get into the moderate range after some months, possibly. But it might be up there for a little bit. That happens in crisis or something happens. These all around the world, we send some of our workers to, whether it was the tsunami or these other things that happen. The church does a lot, and we'll send people different places to help out in crisis moments. Or if it's chronic, it's something that has been longstanding, right? You're unable to work or care for yourself all the time. You have to call in often out of work or check, you know, your child isn't able to do their work at home and comes up with these excuses and is just looking low on depression. You recognize those changes. And that's the other thing. It's a change a lot of times, too. Something's happened. They see their self see the self in the world in unrealistic ways. There's a lot of negative thinking. A lot of negative thinking that goes on within themselves and the world around them. Everything is just bad. It's all bad. There's nothing good. Even things that I used to do that brought me joy, they don't anymore. And that's a hard thing. That's when you start noticing, oh, you used to even like going outside and playing. You used to like even whatever it is. And if those things just, I don't want to do anything. Now that happens from day to day. That happened to my son the other day for a day. He just wanted to sit at home. He was taking a lot of these big tests at school and other things going on, and he just wanted to relax. That was fine. But if that happened for the next 2 months, I'd be highly concerned. And the moderate to high suicide risk is huge. So this is huge to understand kind of this and know, and that can help you kind of gauge where things are at. Now, what do you do and how do you help? That's what I want to talk about. And this is another helpful, I think, chart that as you look for things to do for the individual that you can either yourself or your child, again, you can recommend to them the things that they can do, others, and even is professional help needed. And that's what I think this is, that's why I think this is a helpful thing, because in the mild areas, the individual, they can usually try to, you can encourage them. I usually encourage them to, I'll even ask my clients, even though I'm the professional, what do you think would help? I'll ask that a lot, and sometimes they'll say, well, that's what I'm here for. You're supposed to tell me. But I usually say, well, you know yourself, I've known you for an hour, maybe, or I've known you for three sessions, that's like 3 hours of your life. You know yourself better. What do you think would help? And then why try to use those, but help them to solve problems. You tell them to pray, to work, like I mentioned, remember? So you time, but plus the work. They have to do their work, and including the Savior then can heal the wounds that they might have. Reading, exercise, having fun, talking, enduring sometimes. We just have to endure sometimes. Certain things we just don't get over, and we endure. But that's for mild things, mild cases. If it's someone in the moderate range, they have to learn probably more. You have to be more proactive about your coping skills. You have to learn relaxation things. We'll talk about some of those in just a minute. You have to learn how to reach out and find support. Sometimes that's just friendship support, spiritual support, social support, professional support, right? You might need to go talk to a doctor. You might need to go talk to a therapist. That's something that you need to kind of be able to regulate there and say, it wouldn't hurt to go talk to somebody. Let's go try it. And I've had, again, I mentioned the client that I had for 3.5 years. And I've had some that I've seen for a couple sessions. And it seems like, okay, that just validated. I got a couple tools that I can use. And I feel good. And so they probably were in the moderate range there. Severe, though, they need to recognize the need for medical and professional counseling and or professional counseling. If it's severe, you want to, that's again, because that suicide risk was so high. You need to make sure that they get in, get some type of help, that they're talking out loud, and that we don't avoid that or ignore that. So how can you help or others? Bishop, yourself, here's some things that you can do. Mild, explore the cause. Again, just a lot of this is communication, talking. We open that door to say, it's okay. I feel bad sometimes too. I try to share some, I share stories of my life, even with my 9-year-old at times, or even other ones. And so you try to help them, you encourage them, you give counsel, support, friendship, any of those things. Now, that's about what you do for in the mild case. You just be a good friend. You be a good, in a way, sometimes it's we're just serving others around us. We're loving others around us. And that's enough for someone with mild mental illness. Someone who's more in the moderate range, you support them as well. You do all those things. I always say we take those things and we add to it a little bit. You offer those things, but you consider, the final piece on that is a little bit more, you consider that referral to a professional resource. And I think that's important for us sometimes to be able to offer that and say, you know what? I think we need to, have you ever thought about that? I don't know if anyone has ever offered that to you or if you ever offered that to someone else. Sometimes that's scary to say, like, oh, do you think I need therapy? You think I'm crazy? I hear that. And no, I don't. I think that it'd be good to talk to somebody, just like you go check in with your bishop on spiritual things. That's why I think part of the reason we have temple recommend interviews on a regular basis, to check in a way, right? And our accountability, we go check our finances, hopefully, from time to time. We hopefully check we get oil changes on our car. Why not get, a checkup on ourselves from time to time? It's helpful. And the other thing, severe though, encourage professional help and provide that support to help get them there. Providing support is, what can I do to help you get the help you need? I'm not the one that's able to do that for you probably right now, but I think that you definitely need some extra help. And then just down here, professional help. It's usually not necessary with mild. Sometimes someone at LDS Family Services or another resource is maybe needed for moderate. But that's all that we do at LDS Family Services is more moderate care, we call it. If it's severe, usually that's something they need more than just a once a week for an hour a week to go check in with somebody. It's okay to start there, possibly, but usually I'll get someone even the very first time and I recognize this is pretty severe mental illness. They might need help. They might need to go inpatient. They might need to go to a hospital. Or I'll definitely recommend possibly evaluation for medication, something of that sort that I'm not able to do. And so we recommend that. But just recognize kind of these things that are out there. I think that's an important thing. And I want to spend some time, a lot of the time, talking about how can we build tools that we can use. With that analogy I used at the beginning, right, my grill that I had to build, one of the things that I needed was the right tools. I needed the right tools for the right part of that job, or else it wouldn't have gotten done. And even when it got done, remember, it still didn't work quite right. But so these aren't all going to be perfect for every situation, but I just pulled out kind of four of the main things that I see quite frequently. I don't know if they're the top four ever, but they're the top four in my practice at least. And I'm going to talk about some simple things that you can possibly use as tools. Because that's, again, when I have a client come in, I tell them, I'm not going to tell you that you're going to go away from here symptom-free, that you'll never have stress again, right? You'll never have depression again. You'll never feel sad. That's not real. That's not the plan of salvation. We know we're sent here to be tried and tested. I tell them, you will be tested. You will have a sad day. You'll be depressed again. That's not what my goal is for you, to never be depressed. My goal is to be able to give you tools to fill up your toolbox, so that way when you need a hammer, you've got a hammer and you know how to use it. When you need a wrench, you have a wrench and you know how to use it. Mental health-wise, you have coping skills, or you have the right referral, you have the person you know you need to go to. And so the first one I want to talk about, one of the main ones I see, is anxiety. People that are dealing with anxiety. Right, when you're dealing with that, and if we think back to that big list of symptoms, some of these extremes that you're having, extreme or excessive worry, extreme or excessiveness where negative thinking, that I can't, I have these racing thoughts. A lot of things that have to do with anxiety, often I mention you have to deal with things like meditation or mindfulness, if you've heard of that, trying to just calm your mind and your body down a little bit. Sometimes it literally is a speeding heart, if you've ever had like a panic attack or something. I had that back when I was in graduate school. That was something that was scary. I was a relatively healthy young man at the time, I think. I ran a lot and other things, and my more new wife, within the first year or two, thought I was having a heart attack or something. She's like, what's going on? And I'd never experienced that, but I realized we were having our first child. We were getting ready to move across country. We were I was graduating in graduate school. All these big things happened. I was working full-time job, had a full-time internship, school. I think a lot of that just built up, and I'd never had something like that before. I felt usually pretty good. I thought I was even handling it well, but I had to learn how to, I need to kind of calm down. I've maybe been bottling a lot of this up even. So that's where I first started realizing how to do certain things, and I'll just put some multiple ones of these up, and we'll talk about them. For meditation, deep breathing, because some of these can go together. Progressive relaxation, sensory visualization, I'll describe a couple of those. Meditation, though, to me is about an intense focus and to be able to breathing. Coming back to the here and now, I often will tell my clients, right now, don't worry about tomorrow. Don't get too caught up in what's happened in the past, because that's usually where a lot of that fear comes from, or worry and anxiety. I had a good supervisor one time that he always said, fear was false evidence that appeared real. That's what F-E-A-R stood for. It's false evidence that appeared real. That's what all these fears are. That we're worried about something that hasn't even happened yet, and it might not. We're fearful about something that happened in the past that really isn't reality. That's not the way it actually happened. We change it. He says, just come to the here and now. What's happening now? What do I need to do today? What do I need to do right now in this moment? Just do some, and then get into some deep breathing. That's really important. Oftentimes people tell me the hardest time is at night when they're lying kind of alone in their thoughts in their bed. Whether it's whatever the issue that they're dealing with, that's just when I'm finally alone that my mind just starts racing and I have this anxiety. So we do some deep breathing, progressive relaxation. Has anyone ever heard of that? It's a specific type of relaxation. So the best way to describe that would be progressive relaxation is where you, to me, it's becoming an expert on your body on how you experience stress and how you tense up in certain areas. And so one way to experience that right now, if everyone did that, you could clench your fists together as tight as you can. Do that tightly for about 5 seconds here. 4, 3, tighter, 2, 1. Now let it go. Now, first of all, did you feel the blood kind of go back in? Now, just feel it for a second. Now, do it one more time and tell me, what do you recognize about you? So you're supposed to kind of tune in. What does it feel like to actually clench your fist really tight? Anybody notice anything? You feel mad. So you start feeling mad and intense. What does it feel like to clench your fist? Where do you feel it in your fist? It starts to flow through your body. it's like kinking the hose, right? So she says it starts to flow through her body. So it starts in the fist, but also in the forearm and the bicep, and starts to move. I noticed something, and this is when I first started doing this, the fingernails in my palm. I don't think that when I'm getting upset or tense, I do that. But I taught an anger management class for about 2 years that one time, and a lot of people I'd say wouldn't get intunely aware of your body. And be aware. And if you do that enough, and during this time period, and I would do this every week on a different level with the class, I started becoming very aware of when I would get tense in different areas. I said, I'm a jaw clencher. I do that. I grind my teeth at night. I hopefully don't anymore. My wife used to keep her up at night doing that, because I was just a jaw clencher. I clenched my toes together kind of like this. I mean, there's different parts of the body also, and I noticed. And you notice things if you're just laying down doing this progressive relaxation, that means you tense things up. You tense up your fists. You tense your shoulders. And then you really look into it intently and say, what does it feel like to clench my jaw? And I started noticing exactly where my teeth were slightly uneven. And because as you get intently aware of that, then you recognize it more quickly. Oh. And sometimes there were times that I recognized that I was kind of tense before I even knew I was really upset. I was driving in the car, and all of a sudden, my wife helped me with that a lot because I'd start clenching my teeth, and she'd ask, what's the matter? Because she could see this little thing kind of throbbing here. I was like, how does she know? And because she could see it, I couldn't see it. But then I started recognizing when I started doing this to my own jaw, and I realized, oh. And I started becoming intently aware of my body. And so the good thing about that is as you do that, then you, ooh, I need to relax. That's kind of your red flag. That's what progressive relaxation is about. So then you recognize, what does it feel like to be relaxed? And then you key into that, and you say, that's what I want. And then when you recognize the next step for progressive relaxation is find where your key areas are that you're tense. So for me, my jaw or my feet. Again, I curl them tightly. Also, and I think mine aren't very outward, and so there are things that only I can kind of see or feel. But as I do that, then I recognize it. And it can change from time to time, but then you realize, okay, I want to be calm. Drop my shoulders down. I sometimes start moving them, shaking them out a little bit. So that's one way to just start recognizing, okay, I'm anxious. This is what happens to my body. I'm going to calm that down. I'm going to do the opposite of it, and that helps. The last one, I really like sensory visualization. That's a type of, you can call it like going to your happy place. It's my way of changing that up to something that actually works. My happy place often is the beach. The beach, but if I just say I'm at the beach, it doesn't do much for me. I don't know about you. I'm just upset that I'm not at the beach. So it doesn't work very well. If I just say that, and I always wondered, what is this happy place? But as I've gone through different parts, I've put this together. I call it the sensory visualization, which that is to me, I visualize my happy place, but I go through all five of my senses. And I challenge myself to spend at least 2 minutes in each sense, if not more. And so that's at least a 10-minute relaxation exercise. Sometimes I modify it. There's times I've done it shorter. Sometimes I've done it all night until I fell asleep. And it's wonderful. Because you intently, you visualize, not just I'm at the beach, what do I see? I go through, what do I see first? I set kind of the scene. And this can be a real or imagined place. It's your happy place. And so I'm at a beach with what color is the sand? It could be real or imagined. Again, it could be some off color. I've had people do that. That wouldn't even be real. What do the waves look like? What is the water? What color is the water? Are the waves big? Are they small? Are they coming in rhythmically or just low? What's the plantation around me like? Is it just some palm trees or is it the lush greenery around? Is it, what is it? Everything. You go through that. And you go through, and people go, what do I taste? I taste a fresh pineapple, a frozen strawberry lemonade. See, I've done this a lot. I like that. And I can really taste this. I can smell a pig roast going on over here. I can smell the salty air a little bit that's there. I can smell maybe even the sunscreen, possibly the smell. I go through anything intently. I focus in on that each sense for a few minutes. I go through, what do I feel? I start scrunching my toes as if they're in that hot sand. I feel the hot sun or a cool breeze. I hear this light, metal drum music kind of in the distant, the little Hawaiian kind of nice little thing. I just kind of imagine that. I hear the waves, the slight breeze again. Any of those, and you go through that. I did that very quickly. But if you do that with anxiety, I'm the missionary for the Richmond Mission, or I'm the missionary. I'm the counselor for the missionaries in the Richmond Mission. And so any missionaries who are in field who need help. And a lot of them are dealing with anxiety that'll come to me. And I've had some that have come to me and have used this. And I always say, you got to be able to use this outside the house, though, because sometimes you're having anxiety in a lesson or tracting. And I had one missionary one time who came out and said, he finally got it. He said, he's like, it worked for me. It was working at night, but I was tracting. And that's where he said, I would knock on one door and I'd almost have to leave and tell my companion. And it was always frustrating to the companion. He says, but I was able to do it because I imagined, his was the opposite of mine. It was at the top of a mountain. See, he was a skiboarder. He was a snowboarder, a skier. He loved being at the top. So he said, I just imagined as I walked in between the doors, I could hear the crunching of the snow beneath my feet. But I could feel, and it was just right here. He says, because I had the goggles on, I had everything on, but I could feel this cool, sharp, brisk breeze just pinching and just getting right on my cheeks. I loved it, and I was able to track all day, or all afternoon, he said. It was wonderful. So, and he did. He got it to me when he was able to do that, even in the middle of working. So that's when you know you got it. So that's the sensory visualization. So those are some tools if you're starting to feel anxious, and your kids are, to maybe try a few of those. There's plenty of others. Again, seek help if you need that. That helped because there's a lot of other things. Yeah.
So where do you start?
So you begin by talking. I think you open the door. First of all, so the question is, where do you begin when you're concerned about someone? You ask them what's going on. You don't bottle up and say, oh, we'll see if tomorrow's better. Ask those questions. You open it up, whether it's with yourself or with a friend. You know, have you noticed this? Or I've noticed that you're feeling a little bit, or it seems to me that you're feeling a little down lately. And I know maybe something happened last week, but do you want to talk about it? And a lot of times, especially with teens, they might say no, but sometimes that will open the door. And just knowing that you're available and willing to talk about those things, because sometimes we just try to sweep it under the rug. But if you know they need help, then opening that door saying, I've recognized these things. These are some symptoms that they scare me and worry me. And especially if this is a parent or a friend, I guess it can be, you say, okay, this is more so as a parent because you have a little bit more authority there. A friend, all you can do really is recommend. Say, I'm really worried about you. I think that you need some help. I know, here's some good recommendations that I've thought of that might help you, and I'd love to support you in that. But if it's a child, say, this is, just like when I see that you're sick and I'm going to take you to the doctor. I'm going to. Whether you like needles or not, they're going to have to give this to you today, or we've got to go through this to help you. The same thing sometimes with a therapist or other things. And you make sure, it just starts with talking that out and hopefully helping them see that this isn't, it's not a problem, it's not you. Remember that beginning, the shaming and blaming. A lot of times, individuals, we feel, so you're saying I'm not good enough, or I'm broken, I'm bad. And no, you're not broken in the sense that maybe you're saying it. You're hurt right now. Something's not working quite right. And so to me, it starts with opening that up and trying to help them see what you're seeing. So I always say you come at it, and if it's coming from a place of love, that's the key thing. I write a lot of things down before I have some of these important talks. Sorry, what do I want to make sure that I say? I might even write it in a letter, but I don't just give a letter like that. I'm going to talk to the person. Say, here's what I'm worried about. So does that help? I mean, that's the start. And then it's getting them into a professional. If they definitely need help, it's, okay, we need to get this help. I'm going to give you a coat to go out in the winter. I'm going to take you to a doctor. I'm going to take you here because we need that help. And so, and you do the best that you can, and you pray. And the other part, so that's the time and the work is you doing that stuff, and then pray for the Savior's help and guidance, not only for you, but for them to see that. And it doesn't always go perfectly smoothly. Kind of, again, like my barbecue, sometimes we get it together and it doesn't work quite right. And it takes a little bit, takes some extra look. You find out how they can get bought into that idea. So hopefully that helps. Yeah.
So a little bit. How do you tell the difference between teenager and mental illness?
Okay, were you here when I mentioned that?
Yeah.
It's the difference in puberty and mental illness. Sometimes is the big thick question. So how long it's going on, is it staying in? Usually with just an outburst, because I've got all these hormones and chemicals going through my body, that happens, but usually, hopefully they'll tone down for a little bit, or it'll change. Is it normal right now? Is this kind of, talk to your peers. The other thing that when I mentioned social norms is, are your, peers, people that have kids about your same age, depending on wherever it's at, are they experiencing a similar thing? If it seems too excessive and too prolonged, again, those are those key criteria to me. If it's excessive and too prolonged, then it's looking like this is a pattern of behavior that's not just happening here. And just an opening and talking about that. And possibly getting, you know, that referral, checking in, saying, okay, is this any different than... So it depends on every case. That's a very vague or wide question. There's, let's see, what can I put out there? I don't have a specific book that's out there, I guess, necessarily. I have different handouts that I don't have here. I don't know if it was in the thing. I'll put my email address. If you have a specific question, please email me, because I have, like with this, I have handouts that I've given. So this, it's MackieRS@LDSFamilyServices.org. Because there are some things, but it is, and it's sometimes worth even just calling and checking in on and talking to someone just to say now, because there are so many different things. Like I said, even that the symptoms that I put up here, there were kind of 20 different things on there. It depends. I mean, it just, so... On the situation. So if they're just talking back a lot, it depends on how bad it is. Are they blowing up and impulsively, are they explosive to my, you know, it's, so I always, there's a lot of questions depending on which one it is. But there are some things that we can maybe talk about a little bit more. So how do you help a young child who maybe has a parent or a sibling who's dealing with mental illness? Okay, that's a good question. I call those people the silent sufferers. That's the title that I often give. Because usually the person who's dealing with a mental illness, they're the ones hopefully getting help, meeting sometimes with the bishop, meeting with the counselor and other things, but the rest of the family is not. And we need to make sure we're recognizing those silent sufferers. So talking to them, do you have any questions about what Johnny's going through or what mommy's doing? Or here's how, and sometimes even having, I like opening it up in the family because hopefully that's a safe environment. And even having the one dealing with it being very much involved in a family-type lesson about it. Like, here's how you can help me. I'm going to, and hopefully they are going to a therapist or getting medication. Say, here's, and they can even say, here's what I'm dealing with. Here's how it affects me. Here's how you can help. If you can do something like that, that's the ideal. Sometimes they're not as bought into participating in that, or sometimes they're young enough to where they don't have much to say. They might be just 11 and whatever and just started to get it, so they don't have much to say. But you even say, hey, Johnny, we're going to have a family lesson about how, because we want you to be happy and successful. That's what our family is about. So addressing it head on, because as we open it up, that to me is where true revelation can come. We can counsel together. We can see that everyone loves me, that I'm not just pigeonholed, I'm not just this problem, but everyone wants to love me and help me. That's the, if it can you put together like that, then that's a good area at least to go in. I recommend that a lot, to be able to do that. Because then we know we can talk about it, and we know how to actually ask questions. One more that I need to go on. The question is it confidential working through LDS Family Services? It absolutely is. We're put to the same HIPAA laws as everyone else. And if someone is working with their bishop, they can put on their confidentiality form their bishop's name. I'd say more than half don't, and so that's fine. If the bishop is paying for it in some way or helping out a little bit of the cost, then we have to have it because they get part of the bill. But the client can always say, I don't want this shared with my bishop, and that is real. I always recommend if it's something that we're working with, that something comes up and I say, I think this would be something good to work on. So I always say, I'm not your bishop. Even if I were a bishop, I'm not yours. I sometimes will recommend this would be worthwhile talking to your bishop about. This is more of a spiritual thing we're getting into. I'm your kind of mental health, emotional health person. But it is confidential. So absolutely, it's confidential to parents, everyone. We're very much a professional agency. So you can be safe in there. Let me just review the last few tools, and I wanted to share one more thing. I'll just put them all up here. Depression was the next one. And these are just a couple of tools that I'll give you. There's things like challenging negative thinking when you're depressed, and that, there's a whole good old handout on that too about the negative thinking that we go through, whether that's black and white thinking, all or nothing thinking, catastrophizing every event, changing the past to something more negative, even a good event. And a couple who, well, often I'll go when couples are coming in for marital issues, tell me about it when times were good, and when they say it's never been good, tell me about when you guys got engaged. Hopefully that was at least a happy moment. And they'll say, no, I felt pressured into, okay, I mean, everything. I changed the past to every single, how did you possibly get to the altar to be married? If every single thing was ever, your every interaction, I would try to get something. That's a scary thing. So you challenge that negative thinking, though. You think the opposite. There's a lot of things that can go into how to do that. A gratitude journal. I love a talk that Elder Eyring gave called Oh, Remember, Remember, back now it's been probably almost 10 years ago or so that he gave in conference about a gratitude journal to type thing, about how he writes, how have I seen the hand of the Lord bless me or those that I love today? It's a great one. I'm glad you got that. I love that. And so I'll recommend that people even read that and say, this is how we're going to kind of work that, to see something that's happening good in your life, at least on even when things are going bad, you can still see that. That actually helped Elder Eyring. So that increased his testimony when he was able to, even in the bad times, when hard times were going on, that there were still things to be grateful for. I am statements is what that says. There's a couple different activities. Write down what am I? What are my talents, my characteristics about who I am? There's a family home evening lesson I sometimes do where we put a big circle or a big paper and you put your name in the middle and everyone kind of passes it around. Like, what is, and they can even share, what is it about Billy or Sarah that they are, that they're talented in what way? How would you describe yourself? The other thing, using and developing your talents in different new ways is a good way to start changing things that you're feeling bad about. I'm just going to put all these up here because we've only got a couple minutes left. Pornography addiction, so changing your activity and your environment, that's just an immediate thing to just change. If you're in bed thinking or viewing something or thinking about it, then you change your activity, get off the computer, off the phone, and get out of your environment, out of the bedroom or off the computer, going into the kitchen to get a drink of water. I mean, that's a bunch of different ways. Sensory overload, another one of these sensory things. Do something that involves all five of your senses if you can. So I have someone who go and will play the piano while chewing on some gum. They lit a candle right there. And they're hearing the music, they're feeling the keys. I mean, that's just a simple way. But if you can do things, that your brain is sensory overload. Your brain can't ponder and think on these things if it's overloaded with all these different senses. I've had people go outside and run and do other things while they're listening to music and, again, chewing something or whatever it is the case. And so there's things like that. The battlefield exercise, what that is there's a good book out there. It's called Every Man's Battle that talks about three main battles that people dealing with pornography addiction go through. That's the battle over the eyes. It's first just not viewing pornography anymore. And then it's the battle over the mind, where I'm not thinking about it anymore, and the battle over the heart. I no longer have desires to do evil, basically. I don't even want to. So I always tell people, where are you at? Which battle are you fighting right now? Because some people will say, they come to me brokenhearted. I don't have the desires to see it, but I'm addicted to viewing it. And so we say, okay, so you're dealing with the battle over the eyes. You need to start just turning your eyes every time you're remotely seeing anything that could be lead you down that path. Or maybe it's your mind. You have a hard time when you lay down at night with the thoughts. Anyway, that's the battlefield exercise. And there's other things that we have. For anger, recognizing the tension in your bodies, turning away. The turn away agreement is, you can't just run away. A child can't just say, well, I'm leaving if you're making me mad, and go and slam the door. The agreement is that they say, I'm going to take a, they have to call it. See, I got to take a timeout, mom, or whatever. Got to call it, set a time limit, and you honor it. Those are the three things in the timeout agreement. So you call it in some way, I'm taking a timeout. You set a time limit, I'm going to go in my room for 30 minutes or whatever, and I honor it. No matter what, you come back out. This, I use these with marital couples too, having a problem. No matter what, even if you go in the other room and stew about it, you still got to come back and talk about it. Or come back and say, you know what, I love you, and because I love you, I don't want to argue, so we're going to call it for another 15 minutes. And then tension reducers, that's just doing things that calm you down. So, sorry we ran out of a lot of time. The last thing I wanted to just say, the final word is that when in doubt, always seek help. There's so many things. You don't have to do this alone. I don't want you to ever think that you can. You can call LDS Family Services and even get a free consult. Is this something that I might need help with if you're ever in doubt? But trusted family, and trusted is the key word. It's not all family, it's just someone that you talk to. Trusted family, trusted friends, bishops, mental health providers, physical health providers, school counselors. There's so many people available. You don't have to do this alone. And so my testimony is just knowing that as we do this, that I'm going to end with what I started with. My equation for healing is that as time goes by, and as you do the right work, and as you include the Savior, that you will be able to find healing in your life or for those that you love. And if you do that, then I know the Spirit will guide you and you'll find happiness and joy in your life and answers to whatever those questions are, because there's a lot of different mental illnesses out there. And I say that in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.